Hey folks, and tonight's episode is brought to you by YesPleaseVintage.com. If you're in the States and a fan of vintage and upcycled housewares and clothing, give YesPleaseVintage.com a check for clothing, jewelry, homeware, and some really awesome finds. So go check them out now at YesPleaseVintage.com. And currently, if you spend over $60, you get free shipping on all orders. Hello and welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. My host, as always, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello there.
Tonight, we look at Martin Scorsese's favourite film and the key inspiration for Bong Joon-ho's Parasite, as we look at The Housemaid. But before we get into that, it's time to ask what you've been watching, and Stephen, what's been holding your interest since the last episode, if anything?
Okay, I've got a couple of things, both sort of purchases I've made, sort of a bit sight unseen. First one is I'm just looking at it now. It's another one of these 88 films jobbies, which is fast becoming my favourite boutique label for Asian cinema. Anyway, even though they do have a weird approach to menus, it is. I'm trying to think what year this came out. I want to say 1989, something like that. The Inspector War Skirts, which isn't the film I thought it was.
Okay.
It's basically a sort of Hong Kong version of Police Academy. It builds itself as an action comedy. It, I'm just trying to see who it's, director, Wilson Chin, there we go, Welson Chin, here we go, sorry. It's really weird labelling because they really want to push the fact that the martial arts direction was done by Jackie Chan's stuntmen. And it was, I think it was produced by Jackie Chan, but like executive producer, he had, you know, he just put some money into it. But basically, a bunch of female cops are trained to be a special police department. Of course, this being late 80s, early 90s Hong Kong. I think it's late 90s Hong Kong. Their attempt at any kind of what we'd now call wokeness around this is totally undercut. This group of women is called Skirts. And then it goes somewhat downhill from there. Got a bit of a cool cast. Sibel Hu, who was a big deal at the time. Cara Wai. Quite big names, and of course Cynthia Rothrock, who this is sort of like one of the seven or eight films that she did in Hong Kong, sort of this American martial artist who became a bit of a legend in Hong Kong action films. And basically that's why I picked it up, because I've also picked up, Eureka recently done all the Yes Madam films, and then that Yes Madam turns into In the Line of Duty for some reason. But I thought it was another one of them. I wasn't expecting it to be a comedy film. It is bookended by two really good action sequences, but especially the opening action sequence is really, really good, and then it just turns into a bit of a silly Hong Kong comedy. There's scenes set in people having dates in roller discos and things like that. I think that pretty much sums it up. The most valuable player in the film isn't even in the main credits on the back of the DVD. So one of the characters, Amy, is played by Sandra Ng, who's like of that age, sort of one of the great female Hong Kong comedians. Although she has this shtick, which is in every film, and you may, if you don't know her, you might recognise her from how I'm going to describe her. Her jokes go around the fact that she thinks she's fat and ugly. She's certainly not fat. You know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But she's a, you know, she's attractive, really. But she is easily carries this movie for the vast majority of its quite brief 90-minute runtime. But what I will say is, because the opening sequence and to a degree the ending sequence are so good and so action, you know, full of action and fun and great stunts, the middle section of the movie, which is a gentle Hong Kong comedy, makes that 90 minutes drag quite a lot. And I was quite surprised how much I struggled with it. However, I thought it was okay, you know, like a solid 7 out of 10. It's not egregious. It's not, what's the word? It's not offensive. And it's quite nice looking at the sort of, there's some little sort of clips at the end of stunts that have gone wrong, you know, that usual kind of thing.
Yeah, the fluff reel.
It's pretty good. It's just not the film I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a more action-packed thing. I had no idea it was going to be a comedy. The other thing I've watched is, so this year, or maybe last year, Eureka put out a box set of films. I think they were called something Vengeance Collection or something like that, which were 8 films from director Joseph Kuo.
Yeah.
Who was a Taiwanese film director who I think he made it big in what I now understand to be called Basher Kung Fu movies, i.e. ones where people just hit each other and don't use weapons. So I think famously, the ones I'd heard of were like the 18 Bronze Men films, but there's more. Anyway, I totally missed this box set, but I had ordered, they've split it into, I think, I don't know if it's just Eureka who did this. Arrow did it with the Gamera box set. But basically, they released the Shaolin, what they call the Shaolin movies, on a single set. And the other movies on another four film set. And you could buy both sets cheaper than you could buy the set of 8. Very weird. So that's what I've done. Anyway, so I finally got around to picking it up. And I watched the first film on it, which is called Shaolin Kung Fu. Which is famous for having nothing to do with Shaolin and not much more to do with Kung Fu. Do you remember what was that Sammo Hung film we watched? Pedicab?
Oh yeah, Pedicab Driver.
Driver, yeah. So a bit like Pedicab Driver, in this town there is a rickshaw firm, and then there's a rickshaw firm of baddies who aren't playing by the rules, and they're trying to take over the rickshaw business in this, like Pedicab Driver, in this town. And they do terrible things, you know, like take passengers out of turn and stuff like that. And also just beat the crap out of people who disagree with them. There's one fella, a young guy, who clearly wants to stand up to them, but every time he tries to, a little voice in his head says, no, you mustn't do it. And it turns out, even though his boss's daughter is crushing on him big time, he's married and he's got a blind wife. They keep talking about her being blind becomes a big thing in this movie. Basically, she got blinded because once before there was an incident that he was involved in with his violence, so ends up her being blinded. So this is why he's got to take a sort of a vow of non-violence. But he is obviously a super duper talented Kung Fu master, because they all are, aren't they? I can't remember who it's played by. I'm not going to dig down to it. The guy's good looking enough, but he's got the personality of a brick. And of course, you know what happens is that eventually he fights back against these people, and you know what happens? Everybody around him gets killed, because vengeance is not good, and then, you know, dig two graves and all that. It's, again, it's absolutely fine. I'd never really heard of this Basher Kung Fu subgenre before, but now it's clearly obvious because we've watched loads of them. but now I've got a new word to use when I talk about it. The most important person in the entire film is not the director, is not the cast, is not the person who wrote it. It's the Foley artist who manages to make every punch and thrust sound like the weight of 7 atomic bombs, and I did find it quite overwhelming. And I know that's a thing in this kind of cinema, but I think because everything else was like both routine and there just wasn't anyone to really like, especially if you don't, you know, like if you watch I don't know, like a Jackie Chan or a Bruce Lee movie, or even there's some others, you know, even if the movie's not that good, there's this force of charisma that they have as that's why they're lead actors. The guy that's doing this one, and I'm sorry if anyone's a fan, I just found him, like I say, wooden. But it's fine. Am I going to go and watch the other seven movies in the set? Well, probably. I'm hoping this is... I mean, looking around, most people say it's not the best one. It's absolutely fine, but we've seen it done before, mate, and we've seen it done before so much better. It also has the kryptonite of every terrible movie. The worst thing about it is it's got an annoying fucking kid.
Okay.
And this has got an annoying kid who's his two character faults are A, being fucking annoying, and also eating eggs all the time. And spoilers, he's the only one who survives at the end with the hero. The one thing I could have done without dying would have been this kid. So yeah, there's an annoying kid, there's annoying side cast, there's annoying villains, and the lead is boring as hell. So again, it's a solid 6 out of 10. It's not offensive. It's not terrible. It all hangs together. It's quite competently made. It was just, I was thinking, are there not better films they could have bought to this party? But I've probably offended a million Joseph Crowe fans out there. But I'm sorry. What about yourself, mate? What have you been watching?
So for myself, there's a lot of bits of anime that I've been watching. I started watching the Scott Pilgrim anime, which has been so far been interesting. I'm only about 4 episodes in, and it took a couple of episodes to actually figure out what they're doing, because I entered into it thinking, oh, it's going to be an anime version of the film, which I'm a huge fan of, and the fact all the original cast are returning. And instead, it's something kind of different. I think the simplest way to describe it from what I've seen so far is that it basically looks at what would happen if Scott had lost that first fight against the Evil X. So when he goes up against Matthew Patel, if he had lost that fight, what would have happened? And that seems to be basically where the series is going at the moment. And it certainly takes it in some interesting directions. Certainly in the way that characters suddenly start to interact with each other. Certainly what happens in the case of the League of the Evil Exes. And while some of the voice cast feel like they are kind of phoning it in, such as like Michael Cera, other members of the cast are still really great, and it's great to see their characters get development, especially in terms of like the Evil Exes. I think there's them in particular have sort of really been flashed out, and certainly Mary Elizabeth Winstead is still fantastic as Ramona Flowers.
Ramona, so, that's it, yeah.
I was really happy that they at least didn't screw that character up, so I'm excited to see where it goes. I'm also watching Pluto at the minute, which is kind of like a cyberpunk detective story, kind of a little bit about Blade Runner, where the seven most powerful robots in the world are being taken out by a serial killer. So that's also proving kind of interesting, and that's also from the god of anime himself. It's based on one of his works, so... I'm very excited to see where that one goes as well, because I've heard very good things. But on the film watching front, there's only been one thing I've watched this week, because Mubai have just put in a selection of Shaw Brothers movies for your viewing delight here in the UK. And some of these we've obviously got on the Shaw Scope collection already, and others that are available elsewhere. But there's certainly some interesting selections on there, such as Legendary Weapons of Hong Kong, One Armed Boxer, Five Element Ninjas. And for myself, it was a chance to watch Clan of the White Lotus, which is the sequel to Executioners from Shaolin, which I believe is on Shaw Scope Volume 1. Officially, this is the second sequel, because the Angry Abbot follows on from Executioner Shaolin, but the way that this one starts with the end of Executioner Shaolin, it's not really too important to have seen that one. And certainly you can watch this one as its own. The film here proving a key inspiration for Kill Bill, especially the character of Pai Mei, as the character of Pai Mei turns up as the brother of White, the former head of the White Lotus clan, known as White Brows. The opening fight is really great, because as it's the end of Executioner Shaolin, so he gets to show his amazing ability to pull his testicles up into his body.
I like all good RuPaul fans.
Exactly. But yeah, the film basically follows the two Shaolin temple brothers, Wu and Hyung, who, after killing Pai Mei, find themselves being targeted by his brother as he reinvokes the White Lotus Clan to go start killing all the members of the Shaolin, basically falling to Gordon Liu's character to learn not only one style but two different styles as he implements the try and try again method of Kung Fu, where he basically turns up at the White Lotus Clan temple, gets his ass handed to him, goes back, learns a different style, gets his ass handed to him again, and goes back a third time hoping to have figured it out. But in the meantime, we get to see some fun training stuff, and I think Gordon Liu is also really underrated because he has such great comedic timing. And while we have those two sort of disciplines of martial arts cinema, we obviously have like the Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, which is sort of like the comedic slapstick, but they're very sort of competent martial artists. And then you've got the more serious martial artists and people such as like Jimmy Wang Yu, Bruce Lee. Gordon Liu's films kind of fall in that middle, as he's got these wonderful like moments of comedic humor, but at the same time he's got real sort of martial arts presence, especially because his films often have a real focus on doing the training montages, and certainly this one being very much the case, as he first off must learn the art of woman kung fu. Your subtitles may vary on the translation of that one, much like in Where the Dragon, Bruce Lee calls it Chinese boxing or kung fu, depending on which subtitles you're watching. But yeah, he uses the art of soft touches, so he has to like learn to do the childcare and needlecraft and all these sort of like feminine chores, so he like can have a more delicate touch because his punches are too powerful, meaning that Pai Mei is able to waft away on the breeze of his punches. And then ultimately it descends into him trying to figure out how to take out the various power points of as in, you know, that's the points of the body, not the thing you made to sit for in the office. Say,
was it one of those business films?
Yeah, so it basically taps into the same territory as Kiss of the Dragon, where he's got to find that sort of key power point to take up Pai Mei, which basically involves him, like, you know, trying to kick him in the nuts and poke him in the head, all these fun things. But, you know, it's a really good Kung Fu movie, and one I recommend checking out, especially in this collection. I would say it's one definitely worth investing your time in, because obviously if you've got the Shore Scope set already, I think you're better off just looking at the ones which aren't on there in that set, as some of these titles haven't really turned up anywhere else. They are obviously available to buy through Amazon Prime or wherever you sort of buy your films from, digital copies, so because they were all put out by trying to think, who was it that put them out now, was it?
Well, they were all on the Apple Store for a while, which is when I reviewed a load. I got a load of iTunes things, and then, like you say, a lot of them moved to Amazon Prime. I think some were on Netflix for a bit. I mean, I was really surprised when you wrote to us earlier in the week and said, hey, look at all these Shaw Brothers films that have suddenly appeared on Mubi. And I'm like, I said to you, to start with, the first thing I said was, are you sure it's just not descriptions of the movies? Because they do that, don't they?
Yeah, they are.
You think, oh, wow, oh, okay. And but no, legit, and I spotted it myself. But it is an interesting mix, because like you say, some of them were on the Shaw Scope Volume 1 from a couple of years ago. There hasn't been a Shaw Scope Volume 3 this year, so I think I'm right that that's died a death. So, but I guess these rights, I guess who owns the Shaw Brothers? Is it TVB or something like that? Must own the rights, and they just must give out short-term deals to people. What I was most surprised about is it's just on Mubi. It doesn't feel like their thing, but obviously they've bought, is it something like 8 movies, and they've done a little collection. I'd be fascinated to see if they're still on there in a year's time.
It is interesting what often turns up on Mubi, to be honest. I mean, you have things like the Doll Squad turn up on there. It's sometimes you've got to do like some digging. I mean, obviously their main fare is sort of like art house and highbrow cinema, but they do often surprise us, such as like their Cinema of Mexican Cinema that they did, which included The Batwoman, for example.
Oh, it did. And the other film that I really loved about the guy who killed his wife. I can't remember what it was called. But again, an avowed classic. But yeah, you know, like when it's Korean cinema, it's usually the same sort of movies, you know, sort of that indie scene, which is fine. You know, I like my movie subscription. It's got a lovely mix of art house, world cinema, and sometimes some new stuff. So things like Decision to Leave. I know that probably is both world cinema and art house in some ways, but you know, it's a way for us to see modern Asian cinema. There's some really cool British stuff. There's some great short films on there. It's really hard to navigate on my TV, but it's kind of it's designed for you to watch every day, isn't it? Every day there's a new curated movie. It's not really designed for you to say, what shall I watch tonight? But I think it's one of the better streaming services, especially once they fix the subtitles on my TV.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, yeah, it is sort of streaming service for the more cinematically adventurous. And I would certainly avoid ever reading any of the review sections or our take, because they often overly confuse films, which I think that they don't need to. And I think you're better off just looking at plot synopsis and making up your own mind, rather than just being overwhelmed by something seeming as more arty or in depth than it probably is. But yeah, as it is, like the BFI player, you've got to just kind of keep checking it and see what's going on. And often they have it is one I sort of like. I come back and forth to you. Normally when they have a deal where it's like a pound for like a month or something like that, I tend to sort of binge it for a bit. But,
I keep with it. I like it, but it is, you know, it's legitimately a curate's egg, isn't it, of what might be on there. And what will happen is I'll have a day off or something, and I'll accidentally press Mubi on my smart TV when I meant to press something else. And then, oh, look at this. And I'll add loads of things to my wish list and then end up watching sort of three films in a day. What I don't do is watch it enough. I'm not terribly sure of all my streaming services whether I'm getting any value for money out of that. It's probably, what do I have? I have Disney Plus, I have Amazon Prime, I have Netflix, and I have Mubi. And I probably watch them in that. I probably watch Mubi more than I watch Netflix these days. I've gone right off Netflix.
Yeah.
Because I used to have it for movies, and that's not really, apart from their own stuff, it's not great for movies. And as we've spoken before, Amazon Prime's great if you want to cosplay being in an 80s video shop.
It's very true. It's a good one to do to go digging through the catalogue for, certainly. Mm. If you like look at what else people have put on there, it's often surprising what turns up on Amazon Prime, to say the least. But I think I'd spend more time just adding films to the watch list I never watch. But with Mubi, it often feels that I need to be in a certain mind frame to watch things that are on there, unless it's something in particular that I've been wanting to see for a while, something like, you know, a Jodorowsky or something by Herzog, because Herzog often turns up on there as do things like A Murderer is also another favourite of theirs as well. So,
They do also get films out into cinemas and stuff like that. So there's been a couple of good films this year, like Pleasure, which, you know, that they actually have been distributing in the UK and doing cinema as well as...
Yeah, they also did Under Silver Lake and Titan-E, and it's often surprising what they're attached to. But then again, it's often surprising what Shudder's attached to.
Shudder's the one that I really should probably subscribe to and don't, because it just doesn't have an app on my TV, so I'd be in that watching it through a browser. And
Shudder would be better if we got the same catalogue as the Americans do, because our catalogue is a pale comparison to what the Americans have on theirs, and certainly when it comes to like the Joe Bob Brigg episodes, you'll find that a double feature is normally just one episode.
Right.
Which is really frustrating, and it just feels that it's another of those issues of rights, really, where you're just treated as a second-class market, which is something of a source of constant frustration for the UK. And I mean, obviously, now it's everyone's sort of like, oh, just get a VPN and you can use the American market.
Is this the point where we get our sponsorship to NordVPN? And
I don't know if we're mainstream enough to be a NordVPN. I always thought the VPN was like this secret grey area, but now when you listen to you go on iPatch Wolf or listen to the Osborne's podcast, and it's all like, oh yeah, we got a subscription to NordVPN if you use this promo code, and it's normally sign up for a year, which is more than most of us can afford to do.
And there are genuine legal issues with VPNs, and there is a genuine mis-selling of what VPNs will do for you. So a lot of streaming services, you're breaking their terms of conditions by using a VPN. So they really shouldn't be using it as an advertising feature. And the other thing is they sort of say, and all your data will be secure. And whilst that's somewhat true, if you're sitting there watching your movies in an open Wi-Fi you found in your hotel or maybe in a coffee shop, but one that you hadn't had to sign up for and your little padlock isn't on. The way VPNs work is you're just letting the VPN provider know what all your data is, because that's where it gets secured. it's not quite as wholesome as it sounds. But yeah, but we wouldn't turn down their money. If they want to fund us...
I'd say there's other people if we were talking about the dream sponsors, I mean, there's certainly other people that I would put above NordVPN as a sponsor. I mean, certainly, we're not going to start choosing favorite children here of who we would like to be sponsored by, because you never know who's listening. But, we would certainly welcome one of them to, if they wanted to, take a gamble on a plucky young indie podcast.
I don't know if we're that young anymore. We're old in the tooth, aren't we?
We're just a bunch of hip young gunslingers in the indie podcast world.
That's it. Hip and young. That's us.
We're not in the 200s or the 300s, like many of the indie podcasts. If you look at Junk Food Dinner or Overnight Drive, even Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, and they're well up in the 300s, and we're still down here in the 120s. So everything else I've watched has all been very mainstream. I mean, I watched the Aisling miniseries.
Okay.
Do you know who Aisling is?
No.
She's that weird blonde woman who drove around Hollywood Boulevard in the pink Corvette.
No.
Okay, well, we'll leave that.
I'm culturally inept, apparently.
Okay.
But okay, was it good?
Yes. It's Emily Rossum, who was in the Shameless remake.
Right.
She plays the title role, so... But obviously, if you have no idea who she is... It may be a bit.
I don't know who anything is, but our audience might know.
Well, I'm cutting this bit out, so this is just for
good,
you.
Good, right? Okay, move on.
So, on that note, it's time to find the objective for tonight's feature presentation, which tonight is The Housemaid. Tonight we're talking about The Housemaid from 1960, a South Korean film written and directed by Kim Ki-young. As we mentioned at the start of the show, this is a favourite of Martin Scorsese, who included it as part of his World Cinema Collection, as a World Cinema Preservation project that he's been spearheading. At the same time, it's a favourite of Bong Joon-ho as well, who used it as a key inspiration for Parasite. The film itself is a film of... Sorry, it's a story of domestic horror as a upper-class middle family find themselves torn apart when a sexually predatory femme fatale housemaid enters their lives, causing chaos and confusion to unfold as the attempts to get rid of her only cause the situation become worse. Stephen, this was your pick. This is a film I'd seen once before when it had come on Mubai, and I hadn't been able to see it since, because it for the longest time, it was really hard to get hold of. And then, as I said, because Scorsese is a big fan, he sort of spearheaded a restoration for it. And I believe that it's like a sub-label within Criterion now that it's been sort of preserved between that and the South Korean Film Archive.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a few of these films. Was this one? So this one wasn't free on YouTube, right? It's not part of this. There's a load of Korean films from this time that basically the Korean Film Archive just releases free onto YouTube.
You can actually find this one on YouTube.
But is it officially on YouTube?
I wouldn't venture the fact it's officially on YouTube, but you can watch it currently on YouTube. So
okay, because just the reason I mentioned that is that there's a whole bunch of, so this is from like this golden age, the first golden age of Korean cinema, and I guess it's just because they're 60 years old, they've all gone out of copyright, and sort of the Korean Film Council and other organizations do their utmost to keep these things alive, either by uploading them onto YouTube or lots of restorations. So something I've talked before about, like the female secret agent and things like that. And a few weeks ago I watched Aimless Bullet, which is sort of one of the other films along with The Housemaid, which is sort of considered one of the classic movie of that generation. I hadn't seen it for about 10 years. And I watched it as a double feature with what I'm going to do to you, and double feature it with the remake, which was which we'll talk about in a few weeks' time. But I kind of watched them both at the same time as a compare and contrast. And I went back and read my reviews that I'd written at the time, and just to make sure I have seen it, haven't I? Because it was quite a long time, and to start with, I've got to be honest with you, mate, I didn't recognise it. And then it all clicked into space. Into space? It all clicked into place. And I remembered what a solid film it is. And I can absolutely see that these sort of films, Bong Joon-ho, you know, it's all up his alleyway, isn't it? It's all about... there's a whole class conflict thing going on there, like often is in his films. So I guess I'll just ask you, did you enjoy it?
Yes, on the rewatch, as I said, I enjoyed it the first time around, but like yourself, I couldn't remember actually much about having seen it, which is not really a discredit to the film. It's, as I said, it's just purely because it's just one of those film watching experiences that you enjoyed at the time, but at the same time, you may have, you can come back to this one and still think you're watching something completely different. But no, this is certainly a really interesting film, to say the least. And I can see why it's considered like one of the top films of South Korea. This is actually the first in a trilogy of films that Kim would direct. The follow-ups would obviously be Woman of Fire and Woman of Fire 82. And then we obviously have the 2010 remake by Im Sang-soo, which you said already you're going to be subjecting me to. So
it's the point of the exercise is that that second film comes from a different golden age of Korean cinema, right? And again, an equally popular director and especially actress and actor that lead that. And it's just, I think it's really interesting to see how the same-ish story, it goes in different ways, but the fundamentals are the same, are portrayed some 50 years later. That's the point. But let's just talk about this one in post Korean War Korea.
Yeah, I mean, this film is obviously set after the Korean War, and due to the economic sort of strife that's been created of this. The film opens with a group of employees at a factory, where we also sort of bunk down at the factory as well. They all live at the factory, and as part of their extracurricular activities, they've got a choir. And Mr. Kim, who works at the factory, also provides the piano accompaniment for this group. And he's not a bad looking chap, and he's attracted the interest of a couple of these ladies. One who tries to slip him a note to get his attention, but he sort of, because he's happily married, he sort of reports it, and the woman ends up getting fired. And in doing so, the woman who got fired, I believe it was Miss Cho.
Oh, God. Following this is going to be hard. Yes, I think you're right. I will. What I'll do, mate, I will go and get my my details up, because there are three different women to keep track of here, and we're going to have to make sure that we keep track. So, Miss Cho is the one who fancies him.
Yep.
Who ends up getting piano lessons, but she gets her mate to write the letter saying, I really fancy you. So it's her mate. So she's Quack, Miss Quack. So Miss Quack fancies the teacher. She gets her friend Miss Cho to write a letter saying she fancies him. And then he just reports it straight to the head of the factory, and he sacks her. Miss Cho then doubles down on this and decides to start hanging around at his house begging for piano lessons, but really she just wants to perv on the music teacher.
Yeah.
So the music teacher is married. Actually, there's four women we've got to keep track of.
Yeah, so you've got Mr. Mr. Kim is obviously our piano teacher here. And Miss Cho is the one who fancies him, and she takes up piano lessons so she can pursue her own interests with him outside of the factory environment, you know, avoid, even though her friend has been fired and ends up killing herself because she struggles to find work, being the sort of economic climate at the time. So she ends up killing herself, and in the process she brings in her other friend, Myung Suk, who's also a cleaner at the factory, and brings her because he says, oh, I'm looking for, you know, a housemaid. And she's like, I know someone you can hire. So she gets her other friend to come in, and of course Myung Suk is an absolute crazy person who says about her own path of trying to seduce Mr. Kim. And Mr. Kim, as I said, he's just trying to get extra money because he's bought this big house. He's trying to do the renovations, but at the same time, he can't really afford it. But, you know, he wants to project this sort of like sense of status and wealth. But
and his wife is pregnant, so she can't help. Like you said, they've bought this house, which is attached to their existing house.
Yep.
It's a bit weird. They've got two children, an annoying shit of a son, and a daughter who appears to have some kind of disability, and his wife is pregnant with another child.
Yep.
And the wife says, I'm too tired to... I mean, I'm being mean to her, but she's very tired. She can't... The house they've bought is a shithole and needs doing up. It's a doer-upper, isn't it? And she's just too tired. So yeah, let's get a housemaid in to help make the meals, keep the place clean. And like you say, I'm not entirely sure what Miss Cho's plan is, but she gives Myung Suk the is that her name, Myung Suk?
Yeah, Myung Suk.
Yeah, Myung Suk. She gives her extra money to sort of take on this job. But I'm not really sure what the plan was. And Myung Suk is, I think you're right, she is a cleaner at the factory, isn't she?
Yes, she is.
But she's dirty because she smokes.
Oh, yeah, she's got a lot of, like, sort of Western decadence to her.
Well, I think she's more that she's feral because, like, there's rats in Mr. Kim's house and everyone else goes, ooh, a rat, and screams. But, and says, ooh, there's some rat poison up there. Spoilers, which becomes a big thing later on, the rat poison.
We'll come back to the rat poison.
But Myung Suk just picks up the rat with her hands and catches it. So she's like, yeah, she's kind of earthy. And I don't know if you noticed, but her skin tone's a little bit darker. Is it because she's dirty or because it's from the countryside? There's a whole kind of thing there. Whereas Miss Cho is very elegant and she wears really westernized clothes, I think you'd say. She looks like somebody from the 50s, right? She could have been in an American 50s film. And then his wife, I don't think we ever find out her first name, Mrs. Kim, is wearing a traditional, is it called a hanbok? their traditional Korean outfit. So she's like from a more traditional time. But yeah, poor Mr. Kim. I say poor Mr. Kim. We're going to slag him off in a minute. You know, he's got one woman lusting after him. He's got a crazy woman in the kitchen. And his wife is a bit needy.
Well, this is the thing. You're banging on Mrs. Kim. Mrs. Kim is, she is pregnant. She's also a seamstress who's working night and day. To sort of earn and keep. She's falling asleep at her sort of like to her sewing machine, which, you know, is never the best thing, because this is like not an electric sewing machine where you've got the foot pedal. This is sort of like the one you wind up and it sort of goes. So to fall asleep in front of that is not the
best
thing.
I've been a bit mean to Mrs. Kim, although later on I'm going to be a bit mean to her again. Okay. But yes, of course she does. She's working really hard, but there is all this sort of psychosexual drama going on in the house, which is where most of this film is set as well, apart from a few scenes at the factory. I think on the whole everything happens within the house. And maybe just outside and stuff like that. But yeah, he basically gets in a position where he's got his wife, he's got this woman coming around for piano lessons who's trying to seduce him. He later out finds that he basically caused a woman to kill herself, and he's got this predatory wild woman who his kids can't stand either. They're terrified of her.
No.
It's horrible to them.
And yeah, I mean, the warning signs are there. I mean, she bludgeons a rat as soon as she goes in there. So, and he's like, no, how about you use the rat poison? But I love the fact when the rat poison's introduced into this film, because the rat poison plays like, it's almost like another character in itself, the amount of screen time this rat poison gets. He gets the rat poison out of the cupboard, and he's sort of like, and then he gives it to his kids, and he's sort of like, "You sure this is poisonous?" It's like, "Why did you give it to the kids if it's poisonous?"
He basically gets it out of the cupboard where it's with all the food, by the way.
Yeah,
he gets it out of the cupboard and says to them in a really awkward way, almost like he's advertising it, "Hey kids, this is rat poison. Never play with it or eat it." And then he sort of puts it back up, and we have these wonderful shots where we're inside the cupboard, don't we, looking out, and the rat poison's there with a little bit of its own, and everybody who comes into the house sees the rat poison, and it's really sort of signposted, but it is glorious as well. But yeah, Min-Suk won't use rat poison. She'll just, like you say, bludgeon the rats to death herself, but she sees the rat poison pretty quick as well.
Yeah, and we get to obviously see the effects of the rat poison, because he puts it on the rice and leaves it in the kitchen. So we get to see the effect of the poison on the rats. So we know the poison works. And it's really, at this point, I said that as soon as we start killing the rats, that everything sort of like starts going really badly for Mr. Kim. Especially when Mrs. Kim is called out of town and he's all like left to his own devices, really. He's got Miss Cho, who tries to fling herself at him. He turns her down, and then Myung Suk takes the situation to her advantage and then seduces him. And
I mean, yeah, I mean, this is where our sympathies start ending with Mr. Kim, isn't it? Because basically, Miss Cho throws herself at him. He rejects her. Good man. She basically says, "I'm going to fake it so it sounds like you raped me," which really vexes him. I think he pushes her away and something like that. But then falls into the arms of Dirty Myung-Suk straight away. It's like, that didn't take much, did it? Because he was a bit sad. He slept with another woman.
Oh, worse still, though. He manages to get her pregnant.
Oh, yes.
So now he's got a pregnant housemaid and a wife who's, you know, trying to raise the two kids that they already have. And this really throws everything into confusion, because he knows he has to come clean to his wife. And they basically, between them, come up with a plan to try and get rid of Myung-Suk. Because they're now stuck in a situation where she can blackmail him, because it's going to be like a huge scandal, really, for, you know, the piano teacher to be caught having not only a mistress, but a pregnant mistress as well. He's supposed to be like a happily married man. He's supposed to be like a upstanding member of society.
And we've seen how the factory reacted with even the suggestion of impropriety, right? So he'd get fired and that would be the end of it. So yeah, absolutely, you're right. So there's social pressures.
And yeah, it's from this point that the film just goes completely all kinds of crazy, really, as the rat poison suddenly becomes like this key thing where characters find themselves poisoned, or they're trying to poison other characters with the rat poison. I'm really not trying to spoil too much of this film because it's so fantastic, but
they're scared of being poisoned. Yeah, I mean, it is a shame. So normally I say it's this old, we'll spoil it. But I think you're right. I think, let's just put it this way. People die. Lots of people die. The rat poison is usually involved, either literally or the threat of it. And then there's this whole sequence where everyone's too scared to eat anything because they think Mint Sock's rat poison in it. And to be fair, she hasn't.
I mean, this film is really sort of like using that Stephen King style of writing, really, where if you introduce the dynamite in Act 1, you're going to have to find the use for it in Act 3.
Mm.
And this film sort of like takes it to another level. It's sort of like, we've introduced the rat poison. Now, how many ways can we use this one prop that we do have? And to the film's credit, it really manages to get a lot of mileage out of one box of rat poison.
Yeah, absolutely. There's very little else here. Also, Miss Cho, then, in this final act of the movie, do you remember how she left, right? Runs out the place saying she's going to accuse him of raping her. She then just comes back as if nothing happened. Said, oh, so come to see how everything was. It's like, what? And then, I think she gets... I can't remember why she runs away in the end. Probably Myung Suk threatens her with something. but it's like a it is like a gothic horror movie, isn't it? It feels like some of those sort of something like Sunset Boulevard, yeah? Where although on the face of it it's a film about something else, it then all goes a bit horror-y and it rains all the time and the lighting and everyone gets very sweaty and although there's nothing gory, we don't see anything, but bad shit goes down. You know, a child is, two children are killed. That's as far as I'm going to go. Let's just say there's four children in the film and two of them don't make it to the end. And there are suicides and attempted suicides and threats of rape. I mean, this is dark shit, isn't it, for 1960 Korea?
It certainly goes to some very surprising places. I mean, certainly it's... A lot of the violence is sort of like suggested in this. I mean, the worst that we get is when we see Mr. Kim at one point snap and try to strangle Myung Suk. And I thought that he was going to have a heart attack the way that the camera goes, because it goes into that sort of blurry vision. I thought, oh, wow, he's trying to kill her. But in process, he's given himself a heart attack, which would be really understandable because the film is just constantly putting this guy through the ring. I mean, yes, he shouldn't have cheated on his wife, but it's sort of like you did this one bad thing and now it's going to constantly like become this millstone around your neck that's only going to get like heavier and heavier. Because Myung Suk quickly realizes that she holds all the cards in this situation. So it's not just Mr. Kim that she's blackmailing, which is, you know, the traditional thing. It's sort of like, I'm going to blackmail you so your wife doesn't find out. Mrs. Kim knows the situation, but it's sort of like, instead, Myung Suk is basically threatening the family status and their sort of standing, really, by saying what he's done. So it reaches the point where Myung Suk can just do whatever she wants and Mrs. Kim is going to support her as well. So
she's no longer
even cleaning the house towards the end of this film.
This must have been, like, scandalous in 1950s Korea. It must have been, 60s, isn't it? 60s Korea? I mean, it's pretty scandalous today. So basically what happens is Mr. Kim fesses up quite soon to his wife.
Yep.
His wife is like, oh, for fuck's sake. She's a bit angry with him for a bit. But she loves her husband and he's obviously full of, you know, he's very contrite about what he's done, and she basically sort of says, let's play nice with Myung-suk, although Mrs. Kim does a bad thing and tries to kill Myung-suk. Well, no, what she tells Myung-suk to do is she basically says, I'm going to throw you down the stairs so you lose the baby. So she basically forces an abortion on her. And then, but then Myung-suk sort of regains the upper hand. Remember, Myung-suk has been this, like, this feral. She's much, she's also, you know, she's not as intelligent as everybody else. She ends up where Mrs. Kim basically has to allow her husband to live upstairs with Myung-suk.
Oh, yeah, she just, comes.
She's downstairs, like you say, doing all the sewing and raising the child and maintaining everything else for what's left of the family, while Mr. Kim is forced to live with his lover in his own house. He's not too happy about it either, but Myung-suk is just genius, just blackmailed the lot of them, whilst she's also losing her mind, because obviously this isn't right, and we're in a world here where single mothers, an unmarried mother in South Korea during this period probably still wouldn't be viewed as particularly socially acceptable. So just within the walls of this tiny house, there's just so much bad stuff going on. And you just don't expect it from how this film starts, where they're in their little music lesson and he's playing his little tunes and people, you know, these poor women are being forced to work in, well, you know, that they're having to work in this factory, to this sort of angsty melodrama, which does things that even EastEnders wouldn't do. It's just, it is gloriously melodramatic as well. And hopefully you agree, it's really well made.
Oh, it's certainly a very well made film. I mean, certainly with the terms of the direction and things like that, it's up there with Kubrick's The Killers. It's got a very sort of modern style to it, even though it's obviously a film made in the 1960s. It has a very sort of modern style to the film, which I think is what adds to its longevity as a film. Really, something like this and something like Hitchcock's Psycho would be the other example. And there's a lot of things in Psycho that were considered really scandalous in the time, such as the boss and the secretary making love in the afternoon. That was shocking stuff at the time.
This is contemporaneous with Psycho, right? Psycho's 1960 as well.
Yes,
isn't it?
It is. Isn't
that's
it?
When it was made. So it's come out in the same year. And I, you know, all right, there isn't a mummified corpse at the end. And
no, this film has its own completely unique twist.
But this, yeah, I think this is probably in many ways in what's going on here is even more shocking than Psycho. And again, when we look at the 2013 version, I think it's something like that. It's about 10 years old. You know, the remake or the reimagining of it, you'll see how things have changed. But yeah, this is great. The other thing I want to ask is, so my copy of it, I've had a long time, yeah. And a couple of the reels clearly haven't been restored. Sometimes it looks really good and cleaned up, and then there's a couple of things look like it's been recorded off a telly through a thunderstorm. Is the version you saw, is it clean all the way through?
No, there are a couple of sections where it's a little more fuzzy, and from what I've been led to believe, is that even though they had a fairly clean print, there are obviously some sections of the film which were derogated just due to time, right. And they weren't able to sort of restore them, because in attempting to restore them, would have risked damaging the film.
Indeed.
So that's why they sort of remain in the sort of states they are. And to be honest, it's not too sort of noticeable. It's sort of more sort of supporting sort of scenes rather than anything major. Yeah. It's not like you're in the middle of a scene and then it suddenly looks like you've lost your tracking.
It's perfectly watchable. It just was quite clearly, there's a couple of sequences which look like, it's like the difference of watching something on videotape and watching it on DVD. If you're into the film, you won't even notice it. Probably, it certainly doesn't distract. I was just intrigued if it had actually been cleaned up even more than the version I had. But which is a shame. But you know, with AI and stuff these days, maybe they'll get it better. But it looks wonderful, and the you know, it's one of those films that, you know, just some films just deserve to be in black and white because of the way they can work with the colour and the. And sometimes when you sort of shine a light in black and white on someone's face, you can sort of really, it's not just the acting, but you can do stuff with lighting, which I don't think you can often do in colour. It's a sort of interesting, just the general direction, but it's not widescreen, it's all in this cramped house, and just the way that every single person in this movie is coming from a different social status, with very little, I don't know anything about Myeon-suk, really. I don't know where she was born, where she comes from. I don't even know how old she is, mate. But she's just like this wonderful, fully fleshed, really complex character. And I think the actress that plays her is just marvellous. And she sort of goes from this almost childlike creature to this manipulative creature to this evil creature to, in the end, actually quite a tragic creature. And I was really surprised to find out the lady that the actress that played her, Lee Yun Shim, was only in a few other things after this. You thought it would have been the sort of movie that would have made her one of the great actresses of Korea of the time. I fear maybe the role was probably so scandalous that it may have held her back. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the actress who played Mrs. Kim, Ji Young Ryu, she was certainly a very prominent actor. I mean, she's clocked in over around 400 films.
Jesus Christ. One or two, then.
I mean, yeah. I mean, have films sort of like heydays sort of like between the 1950s and 1960s. But she, as I said, she's got to go over 400. But then again, this is Asian cinema. It's got a different work rate in the fact that you're often like shooting six films at once.
Oh my God, I've just read she died at the age of 54. So she's got 400 films in, mate, before the age of 54. God, that's tragic. Well, I mean, dying at 54 is tragic, period. But I'm just looking at a Wikipedia page. It's just a list of films. But it's huge. Wow. But I don't think I've come across her before. And I worry, I wonder how many of these movies are still exist or still available. But yeah, I thought she was good.
For when it comes to the character of Myeong-suk, though, I found it like very comparable to Rutger Hauer's character in The Hitchhiker. She's this character that just like constantly has
in the Hitcher.
Hitcher, yes. Sorry, did I say Hitchhiker? Yeah, she's in The Hitcher. She's just this force of evil that you can't get rid of, no matter what you do. Whatever you try and do, there always seems to be one step ahead, and ultimately, we have this this weird sort of ending the film has before. It's almost like they showed it to the studio heads and they're like, no, you can't have that as the ending. And they've instead we have this sort of like a Wayne's World do-over for the ending, where it becomes almost like a morality tale.
Which is kind of the ending is what I would expect. It is that Korean, South Korean melodramatic way that everything suddenly becomes a little bit chaste. So even though people have been having sex and having babies and forcing abortions and murdering children and, well, they didn't murder a child, but a child dies, let's put it that way. There's not a threat. In the end, it all becomes a bit of almost like Romeo and Juliet, like, isn't it? Where she, like you said, she becomes like this tragic creature, and it's like, oh, we could be together. All I've ever wanted to do is be together with you. Let's die together. And you go, what the fuck? Where did that come from?
You see, I wasn't buying into this at all, because she was like so far off the deep end. It's sort of like he's already tried to strangle her to death, and that's failed. And this was sort of like the ending, you know, call it the true ending of this film, was like the only way he saw it going out, and that's the way it had. And then we obviously have like the ending that the film ends on, where he breaks the fourth wall to warn the audience that the story that they've seen, the sort of thing that could happen to anyone. But prior to that, we have... this is really going to go down well with modern audiences. His wife escorts Myeok-sung off to do things. And it's sort of like, oh, if I let you do this, it'd be like leaving a tiger with raw meat. And it's sort of like, yes, because men can't be expected to control themselves.
Yeah, sorry, you're right. There's this framing mechanism around the film, which basically has Mr. Kim and his wife, although we don't know that's Mr. Kim and his wife when we meet them at the beginning, basically saying, oh, have you seen this story in a newspaper? This man got his housekeeper pregnant. And then it turns out that he's been telling this story of what he's read in the newspaper, but clearly sort of putting himself and his family into the story. And you're right, and at the end, after suicide pact, blah, 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 all happens at the end, which we kind of learn about at the beginning of the movie, then we come back to the present day and he's saying, oh, yes, as you say, oh, you really can't trust men around beautiful women, can you? And he looks to the camera and goes, could happen to anyone. And it's like a really sort of cheeky, chappy... I mean, if it was at the end of a Carry On film, mate, it would be a bit wrong. And that... It just kind of winks at us as the audience. We think, oh, yeah, happens to you, me all the time. I don't know about you, mate. It's just, we just can't be trusted, can we, mate? Because women, Jesus, that is, yeah, you're right. That is really weird. I could do without that bookending bit of the film.
Because it reminded me of, I'm trying to remember who the... did you watch the Woodstock 99 documentaries?
No.
Okay. Basically, in the Woodstock 99 documentary, it just talks about how everything went wrong. And basically, you've got the organisers basically... They blamed Limp Bizkit for inciting, you know, the riots, which basically caused everything to be burned down. Not taking into account the fact that they were ripping people off, they didn't provide water and everything. And as part of the chaos, there was a number of rapes that happened in it, which was absolutely horrible. But one of the heads of the that organized it, I think it was John Roberts or Joel Roseman, I can't remember which one, basically blamed the victims for dressing the way they did and inciting this sort of violence against them. And I'm thinking, how can you sit there and say that with like a straight face? And it just really brought that back to me when she sort of like got that sort of like, oh, you know, you can't trust you around the Foxy housemate, even though Stephen apparently has different opinions on her. But
what do you mean?
You're just saying she seems a bit muddy.
No, she's dirty and feral, and I'm not saying she's not sexy. What I'm saying is that she's sensual and she's of the body, you know, that kind of stuff. Whereas the wife is a homemaker,
yeah,
and like you rightly say, she's working and she's got the kids and she's also in control of that family, because obviously when Mr. Kim admits to it, she's the one who comes up with the solutions, as shit as they are. And then you've got Mrs. Cho, who's like this sort of thoroughly modern Millie character, and they're all different elements of womanhood, I suppose. But yeah, I do. I think Myeong-suk is dirty and sexy and feral, and I wouldn't blame you if you did, kind of thing. God, that's a terrible thing to say. You should cut that out. but you know what I mean. She's yeah. I'm not saying she's disgusting or anything.
No, she offers something different, doesn't she?
She's sensual, I think is the right word, but in the proper sense,
she's a femme fatale.
Yeah, and that's what I love about this movie, is that all the women in this film, all of them, are completely different. Some have agency and some don't have agency, and some, you know, but I don't think anyone comes out of this film smelling of roses. Maybe the daughter. I can't think of anything. I think the daughter survives. But obviously She's carrying an injury. We don't really know why she's disabled. Oh God, her brother's a little twat, isn't he? When, like, do you remember the bit where? Oh my God, this. I mean, this sums them up. So Mrs. Cho comes round to get these piano lessons, and she's already primed to bribe the kids. So she brings like sweets and things. And she gives the son some sweets, who then goes and sits at the top of the broken stairs in the new house. So his little, his big sister, who's got a bad leg,
she's on crutches. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, but she can barely get up because she wants some of the sweets as well. And he's going, ha ha, I got some sweets, come and get them. And then the dad, Mr. Kim, sees this, and when Mrs. Cho sort of saying, "Well, come on. Share and share alike." He goes, "No, no, no. She's got to learn." I mean, there's a lot to unpack in this film, and as a sort of an ex-sociologist, this film, I think, just it's just full of this wonderful stuff like that. And so, there's far more to. I mean, we've talked about the plot more than we often do in these because the plot is so good, but there's also just these other layers of other stuff going on. I'm going to be honest with you, mate. I'd forgotten how good this movie was. I sort of kind of remembered it was good, but rewatching it, I thought, actually, this is bloody good. And I can see why it's held up with such high esteem. The other film sort of at this time, which has sort of held up similarly, is Aimless Bullet or Orbitan, which I think I talked about the other day, which is equally as grim, and people end up doing really, like, one of the, like, the guy's sister ends up turning into a prostitute in order to survive, and other people die, and then there's that scene I remember I told you about where he basically, the guy in the film ends up, you know, he's fought for his country in the war, but he can't get a new job, and he ends up doing, oh, let's just do one bank job, that will fix everything, stealing some money, and it all goes wrong, and he runs away through this sort of building site area, and he just runs past a woman who's hung herself with her baby child and the papoose next to it. And that's just a scene of the movie. That's this sort of wonderful social realism darkness that these films of this time have, and gives you a clue what post-war Korea was like. Because, you know, Korea was this country, this weird history where it was incredibly isolationist for hundreds of years. And it wasn't until sort of before the Second World War, sort of in the 20s, when the Japanese invaded and took over, kind of sort of modernized it a bit. And then through the Korean War, it's had that interaction with the Western culture. So we've got in this film, we've got this sort of, it's just post-Korean War. We've got people very much wearing Western style suits, apart from the wife who's still wearing a hanbok. You've got, they're singing Korean songs, but he's playing a piano, which is actually, you know, a very Western instrument, right? The cigarettes, there's this huge thing about cigarettes where it's, again, which I just think is incredibly, sort of, the pack of cigarettes look like they're American brand or something like that, but it's all right for him to smoke a cigarette, but it's really dirty for Myung-suk to be smoking cigarettes, and no other woman would smoke a cigarette. And there's just this wonderful sort of social stuff going on. And, as I keep saying, the plot is fantastic. I'll stop gushing there.
So, yeah, and like yourself, I'd highly recommend checking this one out. If you've not seen it already, definitely give it a watch. So, well, that brings us to the end of tonight's episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to listen to us. Leave us a review. You can check out our full archive episodes at AsianCinemaFilmClub.wordpress.com. And you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram and Threads. So come say hi to us there. And the next episode, it's a special one, as we're obviously going to be celebrating Kaiju Christmas. This year, we're going to be looking at Godzilla versus King Ghidorah. So make sure you join us for that. And we're going to be going over some of the high points of the year. We're going to be airing some grievances. It's going to be a fun time, no doubt, to be had by all. But make sure you join us for that. And until then, thank you for listening. Thanks to my co-host, Stephen.
pleasure as always.
And join us next time as we ring in the festive season with Kaiju Christmas. But until then, good night. Hey! 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 昨日の恋は忘れて 昨日のあの子は忘れて 踊り続けていたい 夜なのさ 月が砕け散っても 星が燃えて落ちても 踊り続けていたい 夜なのさ 胸に刺さった 恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.